Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a few seconds, but first, it's fundraising time at WFAE, and I want to ask for your financial support. We're providing this podcast free from fundraising breaks other than this one, so won't you consider a financial donation in return? How about $5 a month? That would help pay for the server space for us to host this podcast. Plus, you'll get the Charlotte Adventure Map full of fun things to do around town. Donate online at WFAE.org or call anytime, 704-549-9000. And thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting us. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It used to be that we could all agree that something was a fact or it wasn't. And when something wasn't factual, it wasn't true. Today, we seem to have trouble making that evaluation, and today it seems we tend to believe what we want to believe, and we're willing to disregard facts when they go against those beliefs. Perhaps that is one reason fake news has made inroads. In today's world, news on social media has been weaponized. Bad actors push out stories that have no foundation in fact, and we willingly pass those stories along. That's right. We're responsible, not just bots. Some of the fake news we pass on can easily pass as real, while other news is obviously fake, if we'd only take a moment to think about it. But if it agrees with our already preconceived notions of what is true, we pass it on. It's so easy, and it happens fast. An exhaustive study of misinformation on Twitter found that fake news spread 6 times faster than the truth and reached far more people. So what's so appealing about misinformation, about fake news? Brian Southwell, a researcher at the Research Triangle Institute and a professor at both UNC and Duke, has looked into it and believes it could just be the way our brains are wired. And he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
There are 3 terms that we're going to be using in this hour: misinformation, disinformation, and fake news. Are they one and the same thing?
That's a great question, Mike, and it's a good place to start. I actually think that we can think about misinformation as sort of the broadest umbrella and all the noise that's out there that's false. And that's probably the healthiest place for us to look. I have some distinct thoughts about the phrase fake news that I'll get to in just a minute. But when we think about disinformation, scholars have made a bit of a distinction there. And think about disinformation almost as a subcategory under misinformation. But in the case of disinformation, we're really thinking about agency and the intentional spread, propaganda, the intentional spread of false information. Whereas there are a lot of things that sometimes can accidentally sneak into the system, and we might think about that in terms of misinformation more broadly. Now, this notion of fake news, I think, unfortunately, there's been a lot of cynical use of that term. And so as a result, it's sort of complicated this arena. And a lot of folks are serious in thinking about this, certainly are worried about the proliferation of false information. But when we start, conflating all that with just the practice of journalism and news in general, I think that's a bit of a lazy move. And that what actually has happened is that we now are at risk of undermining the whole system and credibility of lots of institutions that, frankly, are not necessarily to blame. And that's so. My colleague Claire Wardle up at Harvard, she's part of an organization called First Draft. She's argued actually against us even using the phrase fake news anymore. I know it's the cat sort of out of the bag, and people don't understand what you're talking about when you say that. But we might worry about that phrase.
Yeah, let me ask you more about that, because I was going to end with that. Well, since you brought it up at the beginning of our conversation,
okay.
That's fine. But you worry about the proliferation of the use of the term. Is that in part because it has been co-opted, if that's the right word, by people who know better? I won't mention any names, but they sit at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, I don't want to sit here and offer a political judgment per se, but I will say that the willing use of that term when there's an awareness of otherwise is really problematic, and I certainly think that there has been there have been a number of charges against journalistic institutions that don't seem to be founded, and that's really problematic, because there is a vulnerability that we have, that the system has, that all of us have to the proliferation of false information. We do need to think about that as a society. However, that may be different than just using the label for stories that are different than what your opinion is. When we're in the realm of editorial and opinion and political perspective, that's a different thing, and we ought to treat it as such, as opposed to the proliferation of false information.
So you wrote a book called Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health. You co-edited a recently published book called Misinformation and Mass Audiences, and I'm guessing both have something to do with social media and how they shape what we believe. And social media gets a lot of flack for being a conduit of fake news and of only feeding us what we want to hear. But is this really any different from the analog days when the National Enquirer and other publications were sitting on the grocery store shelves at the checkout line, and we would grab them to read these sensational stories that only had a slight brush with the truth?
Yeah, I really appreciate that perspective, Mike, because I actually think that on some level, what we've done here is discover ourselves, that we've had the capability of lying to each other for as long as we've talked to one another. And we also know, on the basis of cognitive psychology and the empirical evidence that's stacked up here, that we have a tendency to accept information at face value and then to tag it as being true or false. And that opens the door for some real complication as well. What's changed, or what's perhaps different in this current moment, is the speed with which we can share misinformation. And this can happen intentionally, but it can also happen inadvertently. Instances in which maybe you have an elderly relative who sees something and either accidentally clicks or clicks before they really look into information too much. All of that is possible now online. And what we're seeing, though, are some really interesting connections. And there's a lot of work in the social network literature that's quite relevant. I didn't know when I wrote the Social Networks book that you just mentioned a number of years ago, the direct through line and connections that there would be to this later book on misinformation. But there's actually, in the run-up to and talking about that book, the Social Networks book, there is an example that I actually think sheds really important light on where we are right now. And it's an example that actually does not have to do with false information. It's an example that has to do with why we tweet and why we share information with one another. In 2013, it's a little bit of a mundane example, but I think it helps to illustrate the point. In 2013, we saw the arrival of Prince George, to the royal family in England. And this was big news for some people. But around the same time, we also were passing really important milestones that year in terms of climate change. And so I took a look at the comparison of those two topics, Prince George versus climate change, on Twitter. And what you saw was that, for better or worse, Prince George outpaced climate change by about a 10-to-1 margin. It's not that different than the ratio that you saw in the MIT study more recently. And so what I think it suggests is that there's actually something important in our connection to one another, the fact that we desire and want to be heard, the fact that we are drawn to sensational information of a certain sort, emotional information, and that is what tends to characterize the fake information that gets tweeted around or passed around. So I'm not sure if it's actually the fact that it is false, which is why the MIT study saw this dissemination and wild proliferation of that type of information. It's just the nature and character of those types of stories. You don't tend to lie about things that are boring. You don't tend to lie about things that are not sensational in some way. So I almost think that part of the story is why certain information proliferates and others doesn't. And then it just so happens that is part of what's taken advantage of when people are putting false information into the system.
So we have all these things going at once, if I understand your theories and your thesis here, is that we have we're hardwired to accept information. Mm-hmm. We read it, we accept it, then we look at it and judge it. Okay. And we'll talk about that in a second, okay. Whether it's fake or it's real. We have the facility now through social media to spread this news to a much wider group of people than ever before. Okay. And we can do it incredibly quickly, instantaneously, than ever before. And then we have the fact that through the act of sharing the news that we share with other people, the desire to belong and to be, I guess, noticed, yep, and to be liked. So if you're already being fed and you gravitate toward news that fits your preconceived notions, you're likely to be part of a group that agrees with you. And so you're enforcing that by sending them news that enforces their preconceived notions. Is that all right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's our sense and our theory of this, and the explanation seems to fit. I mean, obviously, there's still room for more empirical research, but that's actually partly what's so exciting. We've been talking about some of this, and then we see the science article that just came out with the MIT group, and we do seem to be finding confirmation for this. That perfect storm that you just described, I think, for better or worse, is where we are in 2018, which means we need to think seriously about how, as a society, we're going to handle that.
Well, you've traced the argument about how the brain deals with and classifies incoming information back to a series of letters between René Descartes and Spinoza. I can do his last name. I can't do his first. Back in the 1600s. They've been arguing about this since the 1600s. These two guys, I guess, sent letters to each other arguing about which comes first. So what are their conflicting theories, and where do you come down on them?
Yeah, well, I really appreciate your attention to that. That sort of historical footnote, in some ways, that psychologists only were paying attention to for a while, and philosophers, and now all of a sudden it's really relevant to where we are in this present moment. So there's a little bit of asynchrony in terms of their correspondence, but generally speaking, Descartes gave folks credit for being able to filter out if BS, if you will, or false information, whereas Spinoza didn't disagree that we could manage and handle and deal with false information, but he had a sense that what we did was actually bring in information, accept it, and then tag it as being false or being true. Now, what we found in the current literature, and they didn't have access to this back in the day, but more recently they found that different parts of the brain seem to get activated when you're looking at either attention to information or then later processing or interpretation of it, which tends to lend support to Spinoza's account, which there are real important implications of that. But that's the anecdote in a nutshell.
Brian Southwell is program director and senior research scientist at RTI International and the author of Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health. We're going to talk more about news, fake news and otherwise, and information and disinformation and misinformation and how it spreads when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Available now, She Says, a new investigative podcast about sexual assault from WFAE. Listen to the first episode of She Says on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and WFAE.org/She Says.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Brian Southwell, who is with Research Triangle Institute, the co-editor of Misinformation and Mass Audiences, among other things. And we're talking about misinformation, disinformation, fake news, how all of this spreads, and the way social media has changed all of this, and why we're dealing with it so many times in our society today. We're just talking about these two guys back in the 1600s, René Descartes and Baruch Spinoza, who argued in a series of letters back and forth about how we ingest and treat news. And you said that René Descartes said that we take in news at face value. You do it again.
That's great. So Descartes is basically suggesting, look, we can screen out, and we know it when we see it. Whereas Spinoza is suggesting that actually we don't. We process information and then we use our resources to judge it as being false.
And I asked you to come down on what you think is the truth, and what you basically said was that the science is coming down on the side of Spinoza, that we take this information and then later on we decide whether we evaluate it. Well, what's the interval between taking it in and evaluating it? I mean, sometimes I can look at a piece of news, I take it in, and immediately know. That's nonsense.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great question, and I think that that's likely variable. But you're going to see here, you know, so there are lots of instances in which, you know, we're really motivated, and we are, you know, looking for this, and in those instances, it probably is, you know, just a heartbeat, right? Mm-hmm. But in other circumstances, it's longer. And so what happens when across the society in the aggregate, you've got some people who are tired, some people who are distracted by, you know, kids, some people who are, you know, politically engaged in other ways and not necessarily as directly motivated to be making, you know, sense of this. And then add to that, you know, the basis for what's immediately in front of you in terms of information. You know, in the old days of Twitter, you have 140 characters. It's only been expanded slightly now. It's not a lot to base it on. And so you if you don't know about a particular topic, you either have to go find that information on your own or go seek out other resources. And people are busy and people are living, you know, lives that, you know, they may not be as engaged with, you know, day in, day out news, Mike, the way that you and I, you know, might be, and that's perfectly okay. I want to, you know, offer some respect to that perspective. I just think that that's partly what we run into here when we're looking at all this.
And I guess if you're not, your whole focus isn't on news every day, when you have other things to think about other right. than the news, you're not going to be perhaps as discriminating. You're too busy, as you said, or you don't have the tools in your toolkit to really evaluate it, or the background. I was going to use as an example, there are things that on the face of it are just so ludicrous that how could you possibly believe it? And I was going to use as an example, if someone told me today that Martians had landed in New York City, I would just go, that's nonsense. But in 1930-something...
exactly. Right?
H.G. Yes. Wells on the CBS radio network did War of the Worlds, and people thought that Martians had landed in New Jersey.
Yes.
So
exactly.
Is it, and I'm sure we have something similar that we could use in a current reference. So it's sometimes, even though it's ludicrous, we buy it.
Right. Absolutely. Now, what I want to do is escape this interview without disparaging my friends and colleagues in New Jersey at all. However, some might argue that maybe that's not so far-fetched. That said, that's an example I used to use sometimes when you know, I would teach. And this is something that it did happen, you know, in a believable way, because people turned in after the beginning of the break, you know, on that one night. They didn't hear that this was a dramatized, you know, radio play. And so think about, you know, the media environment that we're in now, where there's so many blurred lines, you know, as well. It is difficult to discern, you know, and you know, it's easy to put an electronic masthead, you know, on something and have it sound, you know, somewhat credible. So, I don't know. I tend to enter into this arena from a standpoint of respect for you know, people's lives and for the challenges that they face. And we might think about all this in the same way that we do the spread of infectious disease. You know, so we just got through another rough you know, flu season. Nobody really wants to spread the flu around. Very few people. I mean, maybe there's a few bad actors, but for the most part, nonetheless, we see that that happens. We know that we can wash hands and get vaccinated and do other things, but there are reasons why sometimes that doesn't happen, and there are reasons why in a community or in society, you know, virus spreads almost regardless. And so I think that some of those metaphors are maybe not terrible for us to bring in thinking about this, too.
So once we've tagged that information as true or false, is it difficult to get us to change our minds about it in the face of now, I don't want to say alternative facts. That's also a pejorative term today. But in the face of new information.
Yeah. So, you know, the empirical literature is... there offers some room for optimism when it comes to the possibility of correction. So you can actually correct misperceptions that come from misinformation. It is possible. In fact, that's something that I've looked at with you know, colleagues at the Food and Drug Administration, and we did a series of, you know, experiments. And it is possible, you know, to overturn you know, the false information that a person's been exposed to. However, the caveat is it's hard work. And it's hard because you need to be very explicit about it. You need to say what you just saw, you know, was false, and to be, you know, credible in sort of, you know, illustrating, you know, exactly why that was the case. And we don't have room for that, you know, typically in, you know, the media environment. that we're in. And so it's not enough to just post a correction on a website somewhere. It's not enough to have sort of a weak, caveated story, that suggests why, there's a nuance of this that's, shades of gray. But rather, we need to be just as bold, with the correction as the original. And that's not something that we're want to do, at least on the side of, fact checking and all of that. Now, some of the fact checking organizations have gone further. You think about what they do in terms of their graphic depiction of, false information. And so they'll have, an image, a graphic image of, suggesting something goes all the way to, being in the red and, pants on fire, a lie. And I think that that level of boldness is probably useful, but it also needs to gain the same level of exposure as the original information. And that's where we run into some of the challenge, too.
So researchers at MIT looked at more than 126,000 stories, tweeted millions of times over a 10-year period from 2006 to 2016. And they found that fake news sped like lightning through Twitter, faster, farther, deeper, more broadly than the truth in all categories of information. And they don't blame bots for this. They blame us. It's people doing this, Twitter users. So if you believe that's true, that means, to me at least, we love fake news. We're attracted to it. What does that say about us and about the future of our species?
Yeah, well, I'm still hopeful, despite all this. However, what I think it really does is suggest that two things. One, there are folks that have designed, false information that they are hoping, spreads. And in those cases, there are recipes for information that's going to spread, further. There are outlandish things that you or I could talk about, here, Mike, or that I could say about, how wonderful or awful, this discussion was later that maybe would have more traction than something, more mundane, that we might say about it. And so I think part of what's happened is that you talk about the weaponization of information. People have figured out that certain types of news has legs, and that certain types of stories tend to get shared, and that those are the ones that folks that have some malice in their hearts in terms of trying to spread this information, they tend towards those types of stories. So there's that. Then I also think that in situations of uncertainty, situations of there being a bit of a vacuum and not having official information, some of the rumors that spread in order to try to quiet our discomfort and uncertainty, those get spread around as well because people are trying to make sense of a moment of anxiety. So this cocktail of emotion, of figuring out news that spreads, again, I don't think that the majority of people, and what's missing from that MIT study is a look at the motivations and mindset of those humans who are tweeting. And I don't think that in many of those circumstances, people are saying, aha, here is some false information. I'm going to spread this to my colleagues and my friends and my neighbors. Instead, they're saying, aha, here's information that helps me make sense of this crazy world that we're in. Or that, gosh, I bet you my Uncle Larry would really like, this. Or, my gosh, I can't believe this is really happening. Think about this. If I spread a rumor, I might actually be trying to get confirmation. Is this actually real?
Right.
I can't believe I just saw this.
So we're not acting as propagandists.
Well, I mean, in practice, we may be helping to facilitate that, but I don't think that the intention is there on the vast majority of people's parts.
Yeah. Currently in America, there are a lot of angry people, and some of them are angry for legitimate reasons. Some of them are angry because of the news that they're reading that is not true, but they believe it to be so. Mm. And we certainly witnessed the anger in the election cycle. And evidently, anger is an emotion that makes it easier for otherwise rational people to accept mis- or disinformation. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, this is actually something that folks that are working in different arenas have found in terms of the impact of emotion on our information processing generally. But this is actually also a moment where, with some degree of pride, I can point to one of my former graduate students, a guy named Brian Weeks, who's now teaching up at the University of Michigan, who he published an interesting paper in a journal that I had the privilege of co-editing a few years ago, and has a chapter in this new book as well. Misinformation and Mass Audiences, where he finds exactly that, that anger sort of mitigates some of the judgment that we might otherwise use. And that's really problematic because we can see lots of instances where people are are angry, And if under those circumstances, they're going to gravitate towards information that reinforces their position or that helps to justify their anger, nobody wants to be in a situation of righteous indignation and then to realize that that was all based on a house of cards. Right?
And the Russians used this in Charlotte, evidently, because they, after the election, were able to get people to come based on misinformation to an anti-Donald Trump rally in Charlotte. So the Russians know that anger makes us more vulnerable. You just said that certain people understand the relationship between anger and the desire to accept misinformation. So if the Russians know this, why don't we?
Well, I don't know that we don't. I think that on some level, you think about media content and what draws audiences in certain sectors, maybe outside of public radio. You think about people who are trying to sell magazines. You think about, you talked about that analog world just a moment ago. The National Enquirer had all kinds of problems in terms of its tendency to put a spotlight on false information. But what they did understand was some of the basics of human psychology. And what was going to be attractive to people standing in a grocery store line. And so we've known, advertisers have known this for a while. Political campaigns have been run on the basis of emotion for a long time as well. I think that, unfortunately, though, we do need a more cohesive and coherent discussion about this in the context of social media as they're available now in 2018, in the context of our vulnerability. I think part of the complication with all of this is in the realm of health or science or politics. We don't necessarily want to see ourselves as being vulnerable to making mistakes, and that's maybe slowed some of the conversation. But at the end of the day, there certainly are folks that seem to be intentionally adding noise to this system. But it also really is the case that we are part of the issue and that there's a lot that we could be doing in terms of being better informed consumers and that we could be doing as media institutions even perhaps to help people.
Well, I want to talk about that. We've been passing on fake news since human beings learned to speak to each other, maybe right. Even before that. And social media has certainly exacerbated the problem, but it's not just social media. One of the things you say is that every moment of every day, the internet and broadcast media purvey misinformation either deliberately or accidentally to a mass audience. When we come back, I want to talk about broadcast media. Brian Southwell is with us, Research Triangle Institute, and the author of Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Brian Southwell is our guest. I'm Mike Collins. Brian is a program director and senior research scientist at Science in the Public Sphere at the Research Triangle Institute and author of Social Networks, Popular Understanding of Science and Health, and the co-editor of Misinformation and Mass Audiences. And we're talking about how misinformation, disinformation, and fake news spreads and why we tend to gravitate toward it. Some of us do. And we've been talking a lot about social media, but you mentioned broadcast as well in a statement you made a little while ago. Everybody in broadcasting makes mistakes from time to time, but I'm wondering if there are broadcast outlets that you feel are deliberately spreading misinformation.
One thing that I'd like to actually start with is just our the need for us to recognize that in a society like the U.S., the nature of our media system is such that actually we are vulnerable to occasional inaccurate claims. And the reason for that is that we don't live in a system of absolute censorship. We wouldn't want to. At least I wouldn't want to. And so the way that we regulate broadcast media and our regulatory system, it's oriented towards detecting false information, detecting inaccurate claims as they occur and after the fact. So in a sort of a post hoc way, rather than in a preventative way. And so you might think about this in terms of the realm of advertising, where it is actually technically possible sometimes for problematic claims to get on air. They will be dealt with and usually addressed in some way by one of the regulatory agencies, but they have to be detected first. And that happens when they get on air. And so go ahead, Mike.
But I was going to say, you're talking about broadcast media. What about cable?
Right. Okay. So, you know, as we think about, you know, cable institutions, you know, again, we might think about, you know, what ultimately, you know, the goals of different organizations might be. And if people are trying to draw an audience, you know, that may be different than, you know, always thinking about the broader public interest, you know, per se. And so I think that's a fair observation that it's possible through sensational content to, you know, to draw people to a program. And that's, you know, that may be different than trying to adhere to the highest standards of journalism or a code of ethics.
Well, should we be regulating cable broadcasters the same way we regulate over-the-air broadcasts? Should we be regulating the platforms that allow us to exchange information, ordinary people to exchange information, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc.? Should there be regulations on all of this?
Yeah.
Not censorship, just right. Regulations.
Right. So I want to be careful not to offer a political perspective or policy advocacy. You know, it's not my position to do that, and it wouldn't be appropriate. You know, but I am able to, and I'm happy to point out, you know, some of the logic that we use in order to, you know, to regulate certain bodies. And you think about, you know, the organizations, particularly online now, they are in the business of gathering and distributing information to broad audiences. It may be happening in you know, a slightly different way in terms of aggregating audiences, but you're still talking about mass audiences in really important ways. And so from that standpoint, we've long thought about, you know, there's been justification with a scarce you know, spectrum for you know, folks to be acting and needing to act in a sense of the public interest. And that's something that we could make a decision as a society to do. I would just point out that with a lot of these you know, organizations, they are, as an organizational mission and goal, gathering, distributing information, and that might suggest that they are, in fact, you know, similar. But again, you know, sort of outside of my purview to make.
Well, you know, newspapers used to sell newspapers by the headline. You'd have these newsboys on the street corners in the early 20th century hawking papers with a headline, and then magazine covers would draw you. They would test different covers to see which cover was getting more people to pick it up at the newsstand and buy it. And today we have technology in broadcasting and in cable, and I think, and I know, Twitter and Facebook, etc., where you can see in real time how people are consuming your product, whether they're going away or turning off the TV or changing the channel or turning the radio off at a certain story, or there, or more people are coming to you because you're talking about something. That is valuable because you want to reach the biggest audience you can, but it also is dangerous, it seems to me, because you might start tailoring your information content to what brings in the most eyeballs or ears, and yes, that could get out of hand.
No, absolutely. And this has been an interesting struggle for media institutions, really, at least the last, you know, century or so. And there's a couple of dynamics there. One, you know, it seems like we have things, you know, sort of sorted out and figured out to some extent, and then new technologies emerge, and then new institutions, you know, emerge that find ways to reach mass audiences through them. This is, you know, you think about it, at one point in time, you know, radio was a new medium. Mm-hmm. You know, television was the new kid on the block at one point in time, and people would talk about the relationship of radio and TV to the good old days of, you know, print journalism, mm-hmm. And so you see that, you know, that's certainly been the case. But I also think that we have to spend some time thinking about, you know, the revenue basis for you know, media institutions and what the implications of that are. And so there's some people that would argue that you know, if you are constantly simply seeking audiences, you know, for you know, commercial advertising or for, you know, for whatever, you know, purpose, there are going to be some consequences of that, or at least some temptations.
Because people are motivated by fear.
Well,
and if you put out fearful headlines or fearful stories, and people don't discern whether they're true or false, or even the level of truth or falsehood, then you have a problem, don't you?
Yeah, I certainly think that, you know, this Barry Glasner and other folks, you know, write about this, you know, have been writing for, you know, decades in terms of the culture of fear that we may, you know, find ourselves, you know, in, and the facts that the fact that people have started to take advantage of that is maybe not surprising. I guess it also suggests that we may need to build media institutions that have a different basis for operation. And so people have talked about subscription models. People have talked about donation models, other instances where you've got different sources of support. That may be something to think about here. But yes, the temptation is there. We know that we are emotional beings. We know that we are, and there are good reasons we have our emotions. They're functional, over the long term from an evolutionary perspective. But it leaves the door open to, if we're constantly just trying to attract people's attention, then that's going to be different than having a really deep, thoughtful, considered conversation.
There's something else different at play today. When you think back on broadcast, since the inception of broadcast, really, it's been regulated by the Federal Communications Commission, and there's certain things we can and cannot do. And although those have changed over the years, and I think the regulations have been softened considerably over the years, we were and are responsible for what we put on the air. Newspapers are responsible for what they print, as are magazines. But these social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, Instagram, don't have control over the content that they carry. Well, they don't have complete control over the content that they carry. We are the ones, the users are the ones who are posting and spreading the content, real or otherwise. So how does that change the equation?
Well, yes, I think it certainly this discovery of user-generated content as a possibility is something that we've had for a little while now, but we're only starting to grasp just what the real implications of that are, because who's in charge, really, right? That's the question. Now, that said, it is possible. It is possible for some of these social media platforms, with a few clicks of a mouse, really to shut down the feeds of everybody, right? I mean, so on some level, there are folks that are at the operator switch. And so from that standpoint,
they have millions of users spreading, I don't even know, untold amounts of information across these platforms. No human being could monitor that.
Well, right. So in terms of monitoring, it is an open question, and it's certainly something that they need to think about, though, because it's also it's the basis for their organization. Again, what the right answer is, I think, is for folks to really be thinking about. And I'm not sure that we have a perfect solution yet, but it's certainly a question that's okay to ask, I think.
So in the broadcast world, we used to have something called the Fairness Doctrine, which was repealed, I think, during the Reagan administration, where you had to discuss both sides of a controversial issue. And that what the end result of that was neither side got discussed because you didn't want to you didn't want to devote your entire broadcast day to one controversial issue. Has the absence of that given rise to a lot of this fake news or anger about things because we can concentrate on one side and not do the other side?
It's interesting, as we think about the trade-offs with these types of policies. There are some that have worried and argued, as you just mentioned, that by having to cover both sides, or that knee-jerk sort of tendency to always look for two sides, along the way, we may have missed some really important major public health stories. Think the news coverage of tobacco over time, for example. So similarly with regards to climate change, we saw that the tendency towards trying to look for balance led us to not cover a really important emerging story in the really direct way we ought to have. Now, on the other side, are people possibly able to take advantage of a one-sided perspective? Yeah, but again, it goes to what the organizational ethos is and what reason for being for these different organizations might be. So I think it's possible to operate in an environment where we don't necessarily have that that restriction, but still to act in an ethical and responsible way. Again, it has to do, I mean, it really comes down to whether as an institution you're trying to put out information that's useful for us as a society to predict where we're going. And mistakes can get made. But if it's a matter of intentionally spreading false information, that's a different story than making a mistake.
So given that we live in a country where access to accurate information and understanding information and being able to take in information and view it as being true or false relatively accurately, our whole existence as a country depends on that. You view as urgently important the understanding of how all this works and what can be done to mitigate its effects. But we live in a country also that is balkanized. People like having their own beliefs reinforced by the news outlets who tell them what they want to hear. And among those folks, there is no urgency. Ignorance is bliss. So how do you fix this?
Yeah, that's a great. And you've given me about 2 seconds to
exactly
to
right.
Answer.
You have 2 minutes. You have 1 minute.
The world's
left.
I do think that I think part of it is just we do need to understand the motivations that people have and to try our best. What we really need, and this is going to sound Pollyanna, is a greater dose of empathy. And to understand how we've come to be. I don't think it's our time. I don't think it's the right moment to write off the other side yet. I do think that what we're seeing is that people are reinforcing ideas, but if they really had a broader sense of what was out there and how we all collectively might view ourselves as part of the same human race, that may be a step forward, but that's best I can do in 2 minutes.
And you also say that people should, you have to fight fire with fire to correct information.
Right.
You have to be very explicit about saying that something is false and here's why.
Yes.
It's false. And that takes courage and it takes time and people don't have that time.
We need it.
Yeah. Brian Southwell is Program Director and Senior Research Scientist at the Research Triangle Institute, author of Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health, and the co-editor of a relatively new book called Misinformation and Mass Audiences. I want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much, Mike. It was a great conversation.